This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Sam Livingston.
Hello, happy to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
Just how pro-Iran is the administration of Joe Biden, America's new president? We have a couple stories on today's program answering this question, and it really is quite stunning when you look at it. We're going to start by looking at a decision regarding the situation in the strategically situated country of Yemen, where Iranian-sponsored forces are warring against the government. For this story, we're going to turn straight to Brent.
A couple of the first foreign policy moves by Joe Biden related to the nation of Yemen and the designation that President Trump had given the Houthis, which are the Iranian-backed rebel group that's been fighting against the internationally recognized government for over 6 years now. Back in 2014, the Houthis took over the capital of Yemen, and Iran has used them, support and direction of the Houthis to really dominate the Red Sea passageway at the south of Yemen, which is why this country is so important, because it is the gatekeeper to the southern Red Sea. And what we've seen throughout the past 6 years is not necessarily a stalemate, but largely gains made by the Houthis, where the Trump administration, backed by the Saudis and the UAE, tries to limit the territorial growth that the Houthis make. And so now you kind of have Yemen divided into three separate states, the Houthis controlling the north and west of the country, the very strategic place on the Red Sea bordering Saudi Arabia. So this makes them a very dangerous threat to Saudi Arabia, because of they are obviously against each other, given that Iran and Saudi Arabia are at the end of each spectrum in terms of power in the Middle East. And so you had the Trump administration backing the Saudis, backing the UAE against what Iran was doing in Yemen with through the Houthis. And Joe Biden comes in power and says, well, that terror designation that President Trump just gave to the Houthis, that's nullified. That's not true. We're not going to live up to that or hold the Houthis to that standard. We're also going to, as we've covered, I think, last week, cut off the arms supply that we were going to sell to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE that would be ostensibly used against the Houthis in this war. So they were two specific moves. And then the United States also said under Joe Biden that we are withdrawing our support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen against the Houthis as well. So three major moves within the first week. Now, this designation or the removal of the terrorist designation for the Houthis by Joe Biden came into effect this week. And what is absolutely unsurprising about what took place this week in Yemen following that was that the Houthis used it as a green light to go and take more territory, to open up one of the greatest ground offensives we've seen in years in Yemen, to take over the one last major city they do not control in northern Yemen. This is a city and a governorate or a province that has about 2 million internally displaced people already. So these are people that have already been on the run from during the civil war. And now where are they going to go as the Houthis fighters plunge towards this capital city of this province? And this is, as a lot of people are recognizing, a direct result of the United States backing off completely and giving the Houthis a free pass.
Seeing this kind of action take place in the immediate aftermath of a decision like that by the Biden administration, you would think that this would give the White House pause about the practical effects of a decision like this, but I'm sure we'll talk more about this as we go. But it really does expose just the real nature of the way that this administration thinks about Iran. If you could, we'll talk more about that later, but why Yemen is so important, why Iran is so focused on this. You alluded to it a little bit just with respect to its importance relative to the Red Sea trade. Just explain the strategic importance of this area.
Yeah, there's a couple of really important details about why Yemen is important, particularly the West Coast. And the maintenance and the control of the southern Red Sea is very important. This is where a lot of world trade travels through before it gets to the Suez Canal. Trade particularly from Asia that's going to Europe. And we know in terms of biblical prophecy that it is Europe that is going to be on the receiving end eventually of a lot of Iran's moves, dangerous moves. Its hold on the Middle East is going to affect Europe a lot, to the point that, as Daniel 11 and verse 40 brings out, that a European conglomerate of nations led by Germany is who's going to be compelled by Iran to actually retaliate because of the hurt that it inflicts on it. And so you could say that Yemen and Iranian control of Yemen is not going to hurt the United States of America that much, but it will hurt trade or jeopardize trade or at least put control of trade between Asia and Europe in the hands of the Iranians, or a lot of that trade. So that's one point. A lot of other commentators are looking at this and are extremely worried for what Iranian complete control of Yemen would do for East Africa as well. The Bab al-Mandab is only about 20 miles. This is the southern choke point of the Red Sea. And the other side of that is Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia is not far from there. Sudan, obviously, is further to the north. And then Egypt, north of Sudan. And you had George Friedman from Geopolitical Futures. He pointed towards the potential destabilization of the Horn of Africa, as did other commentators, that this could actually jump across the Red Sea and actually be a launching pad for Iran's further takeover of the western coastline of the Red Sea. Now that's important prophetically, because that same prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 verse 40 of the next few verses indicates that you are going to see the nations of Egypt and ancient Ethiopia, which encompasses all this territory from the southern border of Egypt all the way down to modern Ethiopia. Iran is going to get in control of those places. And so to see a free pass or a green light being given for regime change by the United States in Iran's favor of Yemen, all of East Africa now should be worried about who they have on their doorstep. Hmm. If the United States is not going to do something about this, and if Saudi Arabia doesn't have the power to stop Iran's takeover, then what does Iran do? They tell us what they do. They expand. They want to look for more. And Bible prophecy says that they will find more allies in East Africa, and perhaps Yemen is kind of the staging ground for more of that infiltration.
Well, that's an excellent point. When you just look at the geography of those prophecies and what Iran is going to be doing, the countries, the territory that it's going to gain control over, it's spelled out quite explicitly in those prophecies, and to see events taking place that really open the door for Iran to do that, and at America's invitation in a sense, really is quite extraordinary. Is there where would you send people who want more information about this prophecy, Brent?
Yeah, there's a really good article that Mr. Gerald Flory wrote at the beginning of this Houthi-led civil war. It's entitled "Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East."
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. China has dethroned America as the top trade partner of the European Union. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there was a set of data published on Tuesday by Eurostat. That's the European Union's main statistics office. And it found that during 2020, China overtook the U.S. to become the EU's number one trade partner in goods. So, you know, 2020 was quite a rough year for most economies. It greatly reduced trade between many nations. With the U.S. and Europe, trade took a serious hit. If you look at exports of EU goods to America, those fell by 8.2% compared to 2019. And then with American goods sold to Europe, the fall was even more dramatic. That number plummeted by 13.2%. So, you know, just a major decline there. But one of the few nations that reported growth in international trade for 2020 was China. And a massive percentage of that was in China's trade with Europe. Exports of European goods to China grew over the previous year by 2.2%. That brought them to about $244 billion. And then Europe's imports of Chinese goods grew even more. Those were up by 5.6% over 2019. So that was up to $463 billion. So this is amazing. I think that so many trade relationships were suffering and took just a very big hit. But when it comes to China and Europe, they didn't just avoid a decrease, but there was actually some significant growth. And it was enough growth for China to dethrone the U.S. From a position that it's held for decades as Europe's main trade partner. Now that title goes to China instead, and that's a big development. The chairman of the China Chamber of Commerce to the EU spoke about this on Wednesday, and he said, quote, "This brings a watershed moment for EU-China trade ties." So, you know, quite a significant statement there. And when you look at the figures and when you consider the backdrop that it happened against, you see that that's no exaggeration.
So these statistics show that the trajectory of this relationship has already been on the rise for some time. But we were just talking about this deal that Europe and China forged that is quite a dramatic and could even increase this relationship all the more going forward.
Yes. Yeah, that was actually on the very last day of last year. That's when Chinese President Xi Jinping held a video conference with, you know, the German chancellor, the French president, several other EU leaders. And at the end of the meeting, they announced that they had concluded, in principle, a major investment deal. This is a deal called the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment that had been really in the works for more than 7 years. But it had kept on just stalling and stalling, partly because China was not willing to give in on some of its really, you know, deceitful and underhanded trade practices, and partly because the Europeans were uncomfortable with China's deplorable human rights record. But all of a sudden, they put all that aside and they concluded a major part of these negotiations. So it mostly means that it'll be far easier for European firms to do business in China. They won't be forced to give the Chinese as much of their proprietary information. They won't have to compete against Chinese companies that they are told they're on the same playing field with, but that are actually secretly being given a lot of government subsidies that make them, you know, basically impossible to compete with. So those are some huge benefits for Europe. And it means that two of the most powerful economies on the face of the planet are becoming significantly more integrated. So, you know, that was that major deal on December 31st. And now we have this news that when it comes to trade of goods, China has now overtaken the U.S. And these developments together really show that for the Europeans, America is becoming less and less important, and China is becoming the main economic focal point.
The relationship between China and Europe, between Asia and Europe, and particularly a trade relationship and economic relationship, is specifically prophesied. We've drawn attention to this prophecy quite often. Tell us about that.
Yes, some very specific prophecies at play here. The prophet Isaiah wrote about this more than 2,500 years ago. In Isaiah chapter 23, he discusses an immensely powerful multinational trade alliance that would develop in the modern age, and he calls it a mart of nations. And he tells who the main players in that alliance will be. Chittim is one of them that Isaiah lists. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that this name means modern China. And then another main player that Isaiah lists there is Tyre. And Mr. Fleury has explained that that's an ancient name that signifies modern Europe in an economic sense. And then the scriptures show that Russia and Japan will also eventually join this bloc, and together these nations will come to control global trade for a brief time, and they'll actually use that control against America and some of America's allies. Mr. Fleury writes quite a lot about this in his book, Isaiah's End Time Vision. One part of that says, "The Bible contains many prophecies of that European power attacking America. When it happens, there will be no help or sympathy from Asia. In fact, Russia, China, and Japan will form a brief alliance with Europe. All of them are going to besiege America, Britain, and the Jewish nation. This is why Isaiah's prophecy of an end-time mart of nations that includes both European and Asian powers is so intriguing, and why the trend of collusion between these two great economic blocs is worth watching." So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised, I think, to see Europe and China just working so hard to more deeply integrate their economies. We should actually expect the already robust ties between them to just continue growing stronger. And even as China grows more expansionistic and more malicious, we should expect Europe to keep on siding against America and with China.
Well, Jeremiah is working on an article that should be up on the website soon about this specific deal. China dethrones America as EU's top trade partner. I'd also encourage you to take a look at the article that he wrote in the latest Trumpet print edition. This is the March edition, China and Europe Thick as Thieves. This about that comprehensive agreement on investment that we spoke about. This relationship really is significant prophetically, and as he said, it's something that we need to keep our eyes on, and particularly how this affects the American dominance of the global economy. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. To Europe now, it is official. Italy has a new prime minister. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on Saturday, Mario Draghi was officially sworn in as the prime minister of Italy. I think the day before, probably about even the same time that we were recording our segment, he finalized everything in terms of getting that whole deal together. And he now leads a pretty unusual coalition within Italy. It's, Italian politics are so fractured, there's no coalition of kind of natural allies that will work. So he's got a group of politicians from the left and the right. There's, it's all over the map. There's the Five Star Movement, which is kind of this a libertarian group founded by a comedian that believes in direct democracy. You've got Matteo Salvini's Lega Nord, who he's kind of modeled himself almost as a new Mussolini. And then you've got the kind of the more boring, ordinary mainstream parties. He's going to kind of technically be in a caretaking capacity. So he's kind of not meant to be overly political. He's meant to focus more on making economic reforms, and he's the former head of the European Central Bank, so that's something that he is very good at doing.
We talked about this a little bit last week, and Ron Fraser's writing on Mario Draghi some years ago. What really attracted his attention to this man was this connection with the Vatican and his Jesuit background. How unusual is it to have a man this Catholic in a position of power like Draghi is now?
Yeah, on the one hand, it's not unusual to have an Italian leader that's close to the Catholic Church. I mean, this is a very Catholic country. The previous leader, the Pope was apparently quite happy with him, and the Catholic Church was quite happy with him. He was fairly close. Having said that, though, Mario Draghi really does take things up several notches, you know, to another level. He is a Jesuit, just like the current Pope. That gives them quite a strength. He was also made fairly recently a member of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences. As John Allen, he's a pretty good Catholic watcher, he wrote in Crux, "It's not every day that a member of a papal academy becomes a head of state." So even for a country that it's used to its leaders being close to the Vatican, Draghi is very close. There was an Italian newspaper, Il Giornale, I'm going to guess it's pronounced, that talked about how much Pope Francis would approve of the Italian prime minister's background, and even speculated that Pope Francis may have had a role in selecting him. It's certainly there is a lot that these two have in common. There's so much of what the Pope has talked about, this current Pope, has been about capitalism and economic reforms and having more of a religious guiding in the global economy. And now you've got somebody who's been the head of the European Central Bank, and that is his area of expertise, and he's been advising the Catholic Church on this, and then now he's leading Italy. So there's a close synergy just between even their views on the next big things that need to happen in the world and on those kind of decisions.
And this connection between politics and religion in Europe, this is a huge theme in end time Bible prophecy, particularly with respect to Europe. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and that's another aspect of this story, that Mario Draghi, not only is he closer to the Catholic Church, he's a much bigger figure in Europe than Conte, for example, the previous prime minister was, or many other previous Italian prime ministers. The fact that he's been there at the head of the European Central Bank and not just kind of serving this at any time, but really the crucial moment after the 2008 financial crisis, Mario Draghi is credited with stopping everything from falling apart. So he has some serious gravitas, and he's going to be a much more high-profile Italian leader than we have seen recently. So that could make these links with the Catholic Church even more significant. But we have an article. Andrew's not here, but we can still bring some of his articles in today in the latest Trumpet print, The Pope's New World Order. And this talks about the Catholic teaching on the economy, how much Pope Francis has pushed this, and even talking with business leaders and things like that. And then what that article goes on to show is just how this is something very specifically prophesied. All the time on this show, we tend to end up talking about Revelation 17. I probably end up bringing it up every week about this prophecy of a European combine that is headed by this great church, this great false church. And then you turn the very next page and you go to Revelation chapter 18, and it's describing the economy dominated by this European power. The Catholic Church is prophesied to have a very powerful economic role. And so you've got a Pope that's very keen on that now. You've got an Italian leader that's very keen on that now. You've got a Europe that is in need of some major economic reforms. You're seeing things line up for that prophecy to be fulfilled. And like we've said, that may not happen particularly smoothly. I don't think Mario Draghi has a particularly easy job in Italy, and maybe he'll go out the window sooner rather than later. Who knows? But this is the direction that the Bible says things are heading, and Mario Draghi is in a perfect position to keep pushing things in that direction.
We posted an article yesterday on thetrumpet.com about Draghi. The man who saved Europe comes to power in Italy. We'll link to that in the show notes, as well as the Pope's New World Order, that print edition article from Andrew Miller that Richard just mentioned. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Most of America has been in unusually cold conditions this week. Nowhere was harder hit, though, than Texas. There, the frigid weather was exacerbated by power outages that affected millions of people. To learn about why, we'll turn to Sam Livingston.
It has been a hard week for Texas this week. They've been getting a taste of what it's like to be California. They've had rolling blackouts. They've had water shortages, burst water pipes, frozen gas lines. Now, there has been a massive debate swirling throughout the United States this week as to what was the cause of this outage. Why weren't they better prepared? There's the alternative energy argument here. Texas has is pretty reliant on wind turbines. Those turbines froze this week and obviously create a huge gap on the grid that then needs to be filled by natural gas and coal. The natural gas plants and all of these power plants need water
as part of their intake. And when those water intakes freeze, then the coal plants and the natural gas plants will have problems as well. There is inherently a risk with having to juggle around your supply on the grid between so many different forms of electricity. I think Texas has 6 or 7 big ones that they rely on, and it makes for a grid that's really amounts to controlled chaos in these instances. I think Texas especially, their grid is off the national grid, so it's a lot more juggling around this time, especially when you get extremes like the low temperatures here or the droughts they experience in the summer. Now, there is a lot of debate going around. Well, they should have weatherproofed their turbines. They should have had more insulation on their gas lines. If you're Texas, you look at, well, is it worth spending billions of dollars to do that in a place that is rarely going to freeze? It hasn't experienced temperatures this low in, well, really the modern era. It was a record-setting week. Joe Biden, he's declared a state of emergency for the state. And the first thing that the federal government did was send in the diesel generators to help back up the supply. So there's no getting around it. If you want to use, I call it unreliable energy, you're going to have to get back to using those dirty fossil fuels. The Wall Street Journal wrote, the harder the climate absolutists strive to banish fossil fuels, the more Americans learn they can't live without them. But the public pays the price when blackouts occur because climate obeisance has made the grid too fragile. So it's obviously a system that's going to have its difficulties. The Green New Deal side of things says, well, it needs to be more heavily regulated from the federal government. You can look to California to see how that generally works out. A big issue there is that the wind turbines or solar, they're heavily subsidized from the government, so it's easier to focus on those things and to ignore the backups like natural gas and coal. I thought one thing that's especially relevant now, and it's what Mr. Gerald Fleury wrote about America entering into the Paris Climate Agreement back in 2015. Mr. Fleury wrote, like many other of Mr. Obama's actions, the Paris Agreement weakened America and empowered America's critics and enemies. That has been his intent from the beginning. The weaker America is, the more vulnerable it becomes to being controlled. That is exactly what the radical left wants. It is using the issue of the environment in order to get it. The Obama administration didn't want to get climate change under control. It wanted to get America under control. And I think that has been really the story of this Texas incident over the past week, is if you want to move towards trying to have these renewables, you're going to make a more unreliable system. And like Mr. Fleury wrote, it's going to make you more vulnerable. The government has to step in and it gets more control. Now, that is the climate change side there, the alternative energy side here. The other side of this story that I think, if you put all of those technical disagreements aside over what sort of energy you should be using, this was a historic storm in Texas. It has not been that cold there. I don't have the exact figure here, but I would say in the modern era, they have not experienced freezing temperatures like this. And I thought that would be a good opportunity to point to what Mr. Fleury wrote in February 2018 in his article titled "The Deadly Climate Change Deception." This was written right after Texas went through the Hurricane Harvey disaster. He wrote, "One reason God sends storms is for correction. God corrects us through the weather, and there are many scriptures that tell us this. Could this be the reason for some of the disasters we have seen recently? To say that climate change is causing all these violent storms is rejecting everything God says about this subject."
Well, terrific job. Stephen Fleury has been talking about this subject quite a bit on the Trumpet Daily Show in the mornings. And Sam, I think you did an outstanding job of summarizing a lot of what he has been saying there in about 6 minutes. But if you have the chance, then do listen to the Trumpet Daily or watch the Trumpet Daily. And Stephen Fleury, if you look at the programs that he's done this past week, has really done some excellent coverage of what is happening down there in Texas. We do certainly think about and pray about the people down there in those very difficult conditions. And we will post those articles that Sam just mentioned on the links to the show notes today, what the Paris Climate Agreement was really about by Gerald Fleury, that deadly climate change deception as well. That is also a chapter in our booklet, Why Natural Disasters. So go check those out. Thank you very much for that, Sam. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more on the Biden administration's pro-Iran moves, how Russia is deliberately humiliating the European Union, and more. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
At the beginning of the program, we talked about America's new president returning to the pro-Iran policies of the Obama administration. Well, we're going to look at a couple more items now that underscore this point and show just how dangerous it is. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this week was there were a lot of moves related to the Iran nuclear deal and the resurrection of that and whether the United States would take part of it under Joe Biden. Of course, the United States will take part of that under Joe Biden. That was the signature foreign policy initiative of Barack Obama. And all through for the last few months, it has been shown that Biden wanted to get back into this deal. And so this week, we did see moves towards that on Wednesday. And then going into Thursday, you had the Secretary of State of the United States, Blinken, talk to European leaders about the United States' desire to get back into those negotiations. Then on Thursday, you had the Secretary of State again send a letter to the UN Security Council saying that the UN sanctions that were snapped back by President Trump recently, that the United States now disavows those. And so the snapbacks have been unsnapped back. There's not really a huge effect on the ground for those sanctions because European businesses weren't involved with Iran already. However, it was a clear sign that we're moving towards, again, the United States at the negotiating table with Iran. And so what the United States is now formally waiting for is an invitation by Europe to join those negotiations once again. That should come very shortly. For its part, Iran is saying that unless the United States and the European nations that are a party to this deal, if they don't announce that they are going to remove the sanctions that they're currently under, or that the Trump's maximum pressure campaign involving more sanctions aren't removed, then Iran is not going to join the deal, and that Iran is going to ban anytime, anywhere inspections of the International Agency, Atomic Energy Agency, on their soil. And that is going to happen on Sunday. And so there's a lot happening, but basically it's got the United States showing that they are willing to come back to the nuclear deal negotiations. Iran saying, well, that sounds good. We're not budging. And in fact, if you don't come back now by this next weekend, we are going to ban any inspections whatsoever by the IAEA of our atomic sites of interest. And so this is completely unsurprising, of course, just because the Biden administration has said they'd wanted to do this. However, now it's kind of what the situation now comes to is who's going to blink first. Is the United States going to say that we are removing all the sanctions that you're under, and then Iran comes back? That's what they are asking for. That's what the Iranians are asking for. And then you have the Americans are saying, well, you should start complying again, stop breaking all the rules of the deal, and then we will remove those sanctions. And so that's where we're at right now. Interestingly enough, that phone call between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Joe Biden did take place, the first one after 4 weeks, on Wednesday night. And what's interesting about that is that according to some really close sources to Netanyahu, this decision did not come up. The very fact that the next day that Blinken was going to go to Europeans and say, we want back in, that did not come up in the phone call. Joe Biden did not telegraph that to Netanyahu. In fact, Netanyahu came out with a single statement this afternoon saying this: Israel remains committed to the preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons, and its position on the nuclear agreement has not changed. Israel believes that going back to the old agreement will pave Iran's path to a nuclear arsenal. And then he said Israel is in close contact with the United States on this matter. But that's just, that last sentence is probably not that true. He's probably saving face for the future. So put together, you have a U.S. that's acting unilaterally, hoping for European support to get back into the nuclear deal, and Iran saying, give us the money first, or we're not even going to enter into the deal. So that's what it gets back to now. It's not even whether the deal was a good thing in the first place. It's going to be, well, who blinks first? And so that will be the narrative that I think that is sold now. Iran might be wise and allow the United States say that, yes, we're going back to compliance, because all they have to do is say it, and the United States would then come forward and give them the money that they want. So it looks like this is going to be a quick, very quick, let's say, removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. I think the deal-making process could go for some time, and that's by design, because if the United States is off after a deal, then Iran can get away with whatever it wants inside the region, because the United States will not confront it, because the United States wants a deal. And so Iran's got the habit of connecting absolutely everything it does to the nuclear negotiations, and the United States saying that this is only about nuclear negotiations, which simply isn't true. So back to the deal, and back to the terms of the deal and the situation of the deal making we go.
You know, talk a little bit about what the Biden administration is having to overlook in terms of Iran's belligerence, and its we spoke in the first half about its sponsorship of the forces in Yemen, its sponsorship of terrorism. More headlines come out, it seems, all the time. We just had that high profile incident in Europe where there was a diplomat who was accused and convicted of plotting a terrorist attack. There was an attack in Iraq this week that was pro-Iranian militia. What does the Biden administration have to overlook to preserve this ruse, basically, that Iran is a good faith actor in negotiations?
Well, they have to sell them, not even sell the media. The media's on their side, but they have to just play up the point that this is only about a nuclear weapon. And so, if Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, that is what the deal is about, regardless of what they're doing elsewhere. We're just after that one target. However, Iran uses it for so much more, this deal-making process. Just this week, as you said, on Monday, there was an attack on a U.S. base in Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, to the north of Baghdad, where there was a contractor that was killed. It's a U.S. base. U.S. soldiers were injured. They could have been killed by it. This was done by a Shiite organization, a proxy organization of Iran, the very week that they want to go back to the negotiating table with the United States. Remember, it was a very similar attack like this, a rocket attack, a missile attack that led to the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Mm-hmm. So the last time they did this, well, they've been doing it for a while, but since that time, but President Trump's response was pretty bold to such an attack as this. Yes, there was an American man that was killed, but it was very close. It could have happened. The Iranians didn't care. They understood that Biden wants a deal, and that Biden is not going to jeopardize that by attacking Iran forcefully. And so everyone knows that Iran was behind this attack of a U.S. base this week. But the United States has kind of said, well, we don't really know who exactly was behind it. Josh Rogan had a column at the Washington Post, opinion column. His title of his column this week was "Biden can't negotiate with Iran as its proxies attack U.S. troops."
Mm-hmm.
That sums it up. That is what is happening. And that is what
you said,
the
Washington
going
Post.
To have to overlook. It's the Washington Post. Josh Rogan doesn't often too often write for them, so he's more of a conservative. But that headline is right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have active attacks by the Iranians against Americans, going for blood, trying to kill Americans, and yet the nuclear negotiations are going forward. And it's not just about nuclear negotiations again. It's about money, lots of money that the Iranians are going to ask for. They're going to ask for billions and billions of dollars of retroactive payments for the money they lost because of Donald Trump. And what are they going to use that money for? The same thing they right. used it for last time when they got the money from Barack Obama. They funneled it into the IRGC, their Revolutionary Guards. They funded their war in Yemen. They funded their war in Syria with that money. And so as they actively fight U.S. troops in Iraq, the United States is lining up to give them more money under the guise of a nuclear deal.
It is impossible to overstate the importance of this story. When the Iran nuclear deal was first forged under Barack Obama, our editor-in-chief described that as the worst foreign policy disaster in American history. Now we have an administration that is doubling down on that disaster. The effect that it will have on the entire Middle East, on Iran's ability to put its imprint on the region, on Israel's security and the fact that it's being abandoned by the United States and is going to have to take care of its own security or seek other allies to assist it in that effort, and just the weakness of the United States under this administration and the fact that it is an American president that is providing this kind of cover to Iran. All of these elements of this story are absolutely extraordinary, and we could talk a lot more about this. I think those statements that Gerald Flurry made when Barack Obama was negotiating and working and dealing with Iran the way that he did, you go back and you read the chapter on that deal in Great Again, the book that Gerald Flurry wrote about mostly about the Obama administration. It's remarkable how relevant all of that is now with Biden in power. And really, you have to look at the spiritual dimension to that Gerald Flurry exposed in order to understand what's going on here and just the remarkable ramifications of these decisions on the part of this American administration. Brent actually has an article about this subject in the coming print edition. We've sent that to the printer yesterday. It'll be on the website next week. The title of that article, Middle East Allies Be Warned, Obama Is Back. You can watch for that next week. Thank you very much, Brent, for bringing that story to us. Russia made an announcement this week that showed just what it thinks of the European Union and its vaunted institutions. It's quite a fascinating picture. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so this kicked off actually a couple of weeks ago first when the European Union's kind of equivalent of a foreign minister traveled to Russia, and he was meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, and basically, Lavrov made him stand there and grimace while Lavrov talked about how rubbish he was and about how rubbish the European Union is. And he talked about the European Union being an unreliable partner, etc. And Mr. Borrell, this European foreign minister, just kind of stood smiling and looking awkwards. And then this week, the Russia kind of doubled down on that, talking about the European Union and Russia's relationship with it as a carcass. You know, it's dead. This organization is, they're rubbishing the European Union. And they are, it's statement after statement after statement. You know, that Friday from a couple of weeks ago, they, by coming out and doing this week, they confirmed that's not a one-off. They are deliberately humiliating them. And I think there's a lot about this story that is fascinating. There's this it's waking a lot of people up into Europe, that this idea of having a foreign minister and that's it, and not really having an army and not really having the ability to make any big decisions, it does make you powerless. It means that when someone insults you, you just kind of have to stand there and grin and bear it, and there's nothing really you can do. It drives home Europe's dependency on Russia in a number of ways. I think part of the reason he was grinning and bearing it is Europe was hoping for some Russian help on their vaccine fiasco. They wanted access to the Russian Sputnik vaccine, and they didn't want to insult Russia. So you're trying to go around the world and speak about human rights and things like that is all very well and good, but it's been a lesson to European leaders that if all you have is words, then that's not going to get you very far in today's world.
So this kind of humiliation, this is probably causing European leaders to do a little bit of soul searching when you have a power like Russia that is kind of exposing some of the hollowness of the European Union structures. That in itself it would be interesting to see how Europe responds to this, because there definitely is the contingent within Europe that is very much in favor of far more robust and powerful institutions and much more of a federal type Europe that is going to be able to push back against that kind of treatment. But also there's this element of Russia actually showing that it's very comfortable with Germany as a partner, as opposed to the European Union as a whole.
That's right. I mean, the Sergei Lavrov, when he's been talking, he's been very clear to insult just the European Union. I mean, people have made the point, several journalists, that Europe would never, or Russia would never treat the German foreign minister in that way. And he even went out of his way to say, you know, the European Union is not the same as Europe. And he said, we have lots of friends in Europe, a lot of like-minded people in Europe. And it's just, it's interesting because Germany at the same time is kind of showing this same complete disregard for Europe. Like the Nord Stream, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline is a great example of this, where actually there's a lot of opposition within Europe to that Nord Stream pipeline. And Germany just doesn't care. You know, we do what we want. And then Russia's coming along, and it is almost making this kind of very public. The EU, the European officials, whatever, some bureaucrat in Brussels, they don't matter. Berlin does. That, I think, is another. You know, people have been calling this the humiliation within Europe, and it has been making waves. And this is another aspect of it, that Russia's very plainly telegraphing Germany is the power in Europe. We respect them. We don't respect Brussels. And at this, you know, Germany's fine with that too. If they kicked up they could kick up a stink if they wanted to about the European foreign minister being disrespected. They haven't. And they apparently seem quite happy with that same message. So this is an interesting story, and there's several different ways I think that this kind of ties into what we're watching for within Europe. You know, this idea that Russia is pushing Germany to unite, that's something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has really been on top of, and you can look in our book even, Russia and China in Prophecy. There's a whole chapter where he talks about how this fear of Russia is causing Europe to respond. But then he's also really zoomed in on the German-Russian relationship that we've seen on display over the last couple of weeks. And he has a great article on that, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America, that just talks about how both of these powers are really working closely together to their benefit. And there's a lot we can learn from history looking at the relationship between those two. You tie that in with indications in Bible prophecy, and you can see that, you know, Germany's wanting to make some big changes in the world. Russia tends to be who they turn to. So we're really seeing that aspect and that prophesied story on display as well. And so his article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America, is a great place to go to learn more about that.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. Russian President Vladimir Putin has been under fire from protesters in recent weeks, but he isn't letting that slow him down in working toward rebuilding the old Soviet empire. To learn about his latest moves, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the leaders of Russia and the former Soviet nation of Tajikistan have been making some significant moves over the last few weeks to boost military cooperation between the two nations. They've had a program in place actually for a few years now that gives Tajikistan's military officers a high level of training from Russian specialists. And in a recent meeting, they discussed just how effective that program has been. They talked about all of the increased military cooperation that that it has facilitated. And there was also a new development with Russia transferring some impressive amounts of military equipment to Tajikistan's army. This was more than 40 units of things like armored reconnaissance vehicles and patrol vehicles, also a major radar station. And this was actually all a donation from Russia. So Tajikistan didn't have to pay anything at all for it. There was a big handover ceremony for all of this equipment in Tajikistan's capital city. And it looks like it'll go a long way toward modernizing Tajikistan's military. So, you know, Tajikistan isn't a very powerful country, but it is being pulled deeper into Russia's orbit. And I think that especially on the military side of things, that's something to keep on watching.
Pretty good evidence of what you were saying last week in the middle of these protests, that we expect Putin to make it through.
Yes. Yeah, we do expect him to politically survive and to continue to assert his will to a greater degree, not only within Russia, but in its periphery. And that's largely because Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has called a lot of attention to Putin in recent years because of what the Bible says about a multinational Asian alliance that'll soon be built. And Mr. Fleury has pointed to Ezekiel 38 and 39 to show that this alliance will be led not just by Russia, but mainly by one Russian individual. The passage there calls this man the Prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And Mr. Fleury has said that those are names denoting Russia, Moscow, and Tobolsk, which is another major Russian city more in the east of the country. And Mr. Fleury has said that this is describing Putin. One part of his 2017 booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, says, "The use of all three names, Russia, Moscow, and Tobolsk, shows that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia from the west to the east. The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days." And then here's a very interesting sentence when you consider what's happening with Tajikistan. He writes, "The giant swath of land indicates that the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union." End quote. So, you know, this shows how important it is, I think, for us to watch Putin closely as he keeps on asserting more and more control over Russia and its neighbors, and especially the former Soviet nations.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We have an article up on the website, Russia is Back in Tajikistan, and we'll link to that as well as The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Thank you, Jeremiah. One last story. Leftists in America love to attack the right, brand them as evil haters and murderers. Well, this week they did a hard turn against one of their own. For this, we'll turn to Sam Livingston.
Last Friday, there was an audio transcript that leaked of one of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's top aides, Melissa DeRosso, and she admitted in that transcript on in a phone call with other Democrat politicians in New York that Cuomo's office deliberately froze data that these politicians were requesting, and they were worried about how the information about New York nursing homes would be used against us. So Cuomo's office was playing politics with information and data that could have really saved a lot of lives in New York's nursing home. The governor did not admit fault this week. During his first press conference, he continued to blame the staff at the nursing home for bringing the virus into these nursing homes. Another Democrat assemblyman in New York, Ron Kim, he said that this certainly looks like Cuomo's administration is trying to dodge having any incriminating evidence against them. A few days ago, the governor called Kim and said that he would destroy him if he did not retract his statement. Several other Democrats have said they've also received threatening calls like this before from Governor Cuomo. Earlier this week, the U.S. attorney in Brooklyn said it was investigating Cuomo's office for covering up the data. The FBI has also opened up an investigation. This has been a scandal that the conservative media have been talking about since April 2020, that Cuomo's order to send COVID positives into the nursing homes was causing more deaths than they were reporting. I've got the Trumpet Daily radio show was talking about this in April, April 29th. We've got a program titled The Nursing Home Massacre, and it was obvious to see that this order that Cuomo issued was going to lead to more deaths. So now that scandal is finally gaining some traction in the mainstream media. Andrew Cuomo has been, his brother, Chris Cuomo at CNN, is barred from now interviewing his brother on the network. Andrew Cuomo has received a lot of praise from that network over the last year. It looks like he could be investigated for obstructing justice. He could be investigated for extortion over what he said to that Democrat assemblyman in New York. Now, this is the governor that was praised the world over for his COVID response. He won an Emmy for his daily briefings. He was the leader that everyone wanted Trump to be. And now he is going down and going down hard. He has been praised by celebrities for his great leadership. And through it all, the state of New York has been the worst place in the world for handling COVID. Now, what is going on here? I think this is really a telling story about the era of will worship that we are living in. This story, like I said, has been obvious for the better part of a year. And finally, these big media outlets are reporting on it. They basically just saw what they wanted to see in Governor Cuomo for the better part of the last year. It reminded me of this article in the May-June Trumpet by Mr. Fleury. He wrote this article titled A Dangerous New Age of Worshiping the Will. He talks about how the media swooned over the Obama administration, and that swooning continues to this day. He writes, the media are continually exposing their own rank bias and utter blindness. We must be concerned about this. Without a free and truthful media, a republic cannot survive.
Yeah, really important article from Gerald Fleury, and very deep. I would encourage you to read that, A Dangerous New Age of Worshiping the Will. We'll link to that in the show notes. We thank you very much for that, Sam. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Sam Livingston, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of George Washington. It is better to offer no excuse than a bad one. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.